This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sevasodhi in our Health and Living segment today, our Brain Waves, the 10th episode. And today we're going to go through brain myths. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, our neurogeneticist in the studio with us, helping us understand the brain better. How are you, Dr. Azlina? It's been 10 shows.
I know.
It's coming up to a year now since you've been with us.
It's unbelievable. It's just gone by so quickly.
It has.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so we're going to find out.
It's been fun.
I'm sure it has been. It's been enlightening for us. So we've spoken about a lot of heavy stuff in the past, and we want to sort of go through some of the misconceptions about what we have about the brain.
Yeah.
And you've given me a list of 10 myths that we would like to bust in and get your understanding. And it's all perfectly valid. It's all been questions in my head,
right.
Which, you know, when we read literature online, you always get two sides to the story.
Absolutely.
So then in the end, you really don't know which to run with, right? But before we actually go through the brain myths, how much do we actually know about the brain?
There are parts of the brain that we know a lot about, and there are other parts that we're sort of still trying to figure out. So, for example, we know quite a lot about the visual part of the brain, how that's the cells that are there, how those cells sort of behave to particular flashes of light. We know about parts of the motor cortex that controls our movement. We know about other parts of the brain, like the structure, the hippocampus, and the amygdala, and you know, many others. But there are other things where, you know, when you talk about things like personality, where does that come from? Consciousness, you know, where is that? You know, and, you know, other sort of things like, you know, why do some people find things, some things funny, other people don't? You know, humor, where is that in the brain, you know? So there's some things that we're still kind of trying to understand, and that's where sort of, you know, some technologies such as the brain imaging can help. So you ask people to do certain tasks and tasks while you're screening or scanning their brains, and you try to sort of, you know, see which are the areas that sort of light up, for example. And then you can kind of, you know, hypothesize, you know, that part could be involved. But, you know, even then it's quite difficult to say what exactly is that part doing. You know, it might light up, but what is it actually, you know, involved in?
Would you say we know, what, 60% of what the brain actually does?
We know a lot about the anatomy, about what it does. We know probably a lot about what the cells do, but how it kind of all comes together, that is the
challenge.
Yeah, so there's this kind of big study now called the Connectome, run by this guy, Sebastian Seong, at the MIT. And they're trying to sort of work out how all the neural networks or the brain networks kind of come together and how that's related to certain behaviors and also, you know, disorders that we can get, like mental illnesses and so on and so forth.
The reason I asked you that question is because there's so much being said about AI today, artificial intelligence. And, you know, many people sort of really taking these discussions to another level about how AI is going to take over lot of our jobs, you know, la-di-da, blah, blah, blah. Some jobs, yes, perhaps. The ones which, you know,
can be automated.
Can be automated, exactly, perhaps. But do you really think AI will take over majority of our jobs? I mean, what about jobs that involve human cognition? Do you think human cognition can be digitized?
Some parts can. But I think, you know, the brain is not just a sum of its parts, you know, there's a lot more. And there's a lot that you do based on sort of experience, that, you know, you learn not to touch something sharp because it gives you pain, for example. So, yes, I mean, you can teach, you know, certain software, computer software, to kind of also learn that. So that, you know, they avoid those behaviors. But, you know, like you know, I mentioned in terms of a personality, you know, how do you sort of model a neural network for personality? So I think like you said, I mean, there will be some jobs where, for example, even things like facial recognition, you know, now there are a lot of companies out there that are sort of working on software to offer it to, say, CCTV camera, you know, so that you can sort of spot, you know, wanted criminals through CCTV and just through the recognition of their face. So there are a lot of people kind of doing that rather than, you know, having a person kind of having to scan through all the CCTV images. You just have to, you know, match it with a software with this is sort of what the criminal looked like. And then, you know, you scan faces in the image. So things like that, I think, can be done. You know, obviously, there's a lot now that's been done in terms of artificial limbs. But in terms of, you know, what you said about jobs, you know, I mean, inevitably, yes, because and I think it would be a good thing as well in to a certain part. Like if you think of, you know, calculators also take over, you know, mental arithmetic.
Which has affected us, I'm sure. Yeah. We don't use those faculties enough.
Yeah. I mean, there will be, of course, benefits and there will be things that, how do you say, that it will be a cost to us. But I can imagine a future where not that we're going to be run by robots, but a lot of kind of, you know, the tasks that can be automated. And that's okay, I think, because then it just frees us up to have more holidays. You know, I mean, if somebody can mark my exam papers, you know, and if
relief.
I can automate that, that would be fantastic, you know, and, you know, it would probably do a better job than me. You know?
Okay, so let's go through the 10 myths. You've picked 10 for this 10th episode of Brainwaves. The first one, that we only use 10% of our brain. I mean, everywhere you read literature,
it's
says
wrong.
You only use 10%. I mean, what are we doing with the 90%?
Well, obviously, that's not true. Because, I mean, I was sort of reading up about where this myth came from, and they sort of track it back to this man, William James, I think, who sort of mentioned that he hypothesized at the end of this philosophical essay that he was writing, we only use a small part of our mental processes. And then it sort of, you know, got translated to, well, small part must mean 10% only. And then I think then it's sort of been said a lot in pop culture. I think there have been, you know, a number of some references that I saw. They said that this other movie, Lucy, and then this guy played by one of these famous actors, I can't remember his name now, and he sort of said that to, you know, in the movie. And so that kind of perpetuates the misconception, right? But of course, it's not true. I mean, if we only use 10% of our brains, then we'd only be able to do 10% of what we are doing currently, right?
But how would we know where we stand at the moment? How much of the brain are we actually using?
I mean, if you think of something even as easy as picking up a pen, you know, I mean, number one, you have to look to see where the pen is. Then you have to remember that you want to pick up that pen. So you've got the visual cortex already involved. You've got the parts of the brain, you know, that are involved in memory. And so, you know, so that you remember what the task is that you want to pick up the pen. And then you have your other areas like your motor cortex then also has to, you know, be involved. Your sensory cortex, meaning when you touch the pen, you know, and you can kind of, you know, is the pen heavy? Is it slippery? You know, so you have to sort of judge that. And, you know, what then do you do with the pen? All that kind of coordinated movement. I mean, if you only use 10% of your brain to do something, you know, you wouldn't be able to achieve that as seamlessly as we do. You know, picking up the pen, we don't even think about it, you know, a lot of the time. But actually, it uses a lot of our brain. And actually, you can see that when you do a lot of these neuroimaging kind of scans, you know, many parts of the brain light up even when you're just at rest, you know. And so it's not true.
Okay, but do we know the potential of the human brain?
The potential of the human brain, right.
So are we using it enough?
Yeah, so that's the other thing about why they say that, oh, you know, well, you only used 10%. If you used 50%, maybe we can all kind of just communicate telepathically. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that comes out, right? And maybe we can kind of, you know, have ESP and all sorts of stuff. I mean, I think there's a lot that, you know, we still have to understand about the brain. Whether or not we kind of, how far we can go. I mean, that's the same as, how big can we dream, I mean, there's no limit to what our brain can do. Yeah.
Okay. So we are using much more than 10%.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were some estimates that said, it depends on what you're doing. So if you're doing something very complicated, for example, gymnastics, you really need to, coordinate a lot of part of your brain. If you're doing something, heavy mental mathematics while skipping, for example, of course you would then use a lot more. But on average, you can use up to about 90% of some, in general, 90% of your brain is used even for kind of routine tasks that we take for granted.
Is there a sign that we're not using it enough?
Is there a sign that we're not using it enough? I guess if you kind of look at, that's a whole other show. That relates to person's potential, right? So for example, if you give a child, some children, can do complex algebra at seven. Other children perhaps may struggle a little bit. Does that mean that, a 7-year-old brain cannot do algebra? What is it? What's special about the person, the child who has a, who is able to do this complex? So it can't be very different. There may be parts of the brain in that 7-year-old genius's brain that is different, that makes it easier for them to handle mathematics. But I think the potential of the brain is there. It's just how it's nurtured,
So it all goes back to the early years then?
To a certain extent. I think, not everything, because that's another thing, that actually you can still do things later on in life.
In life. Well, that's a show we'll do in the future.
Point.
Yes,
yeah.
Potential geniuses and how what makes them. We'll come back and, sort of look at more myths about the brain. We're going to look at the right brain and left brain dominance. Men and women, are we really wired differently? Sleep, can we catch up on the weekends on sleep and how that affects us? And will a knock on the head make us stupid? That's kind coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. In our 10th episode of Brainwaves, Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, our neurogeneticist, is busting brain myths. We've gone through whether or not we use only just 10% of the brain. The next one, Dr. Azlina, the right-left brain dominance. What's the general structure of the brain? Is it really left and right brain? Is that really true that if you're right, you're more inclined towards your right brain, you're more creative, left brain, you're more analytical, you're more, facts-based, is that really true?
Not strictly speaking. So there are certain areas in the brain that are dominated. So certain things that we do that are dominated by parts of the brain which are on one side and not the other. So for example, for the most part, about 90% of people who are right-handed, their language center is on the left side of the brain. And for about 70% of people who are left-handed, their language center is also on the left. So there is this sort of, they call it lateralization. So you have certain tasks or abilities that you do that are controlled by either the left side of the brain or the right side of the brain. But generally, cognition is you need both sides. And that's another widely spread misconception that, you even now in education, they're sort of trying to tailor how you learn based on whether or not you're right-brained or left-brained.
Yes.
And
it's
that's
a capitalist world.
Yeah, but that's not really, it's not strictly true. Yeah, so for example, there was a study in 2013 by this University of Utah in the States, and they looked at 1,000 young people, right, between the ages of 7 to 29, and they divided up the brain to about 7,000 different regions, and they wanted to see whether or not, you were right-handed or left-handed. Did you see the sort of, the left side being more activated in some children or some individuals than others? And there was no evidence for sightness or lateralization, as I said. And actually, if you look at a brain image of a mathematician or an artist, you know, you wouldn't really be able to tell any difference. So even actually this sort of concept of left brain and right brain, it's not so like I said, some tasks, yes, but for overall cognition, it's more a kind of figure of speech. It's not really supported anatomically.
Okay, yeah. So not quite the case.
No.
Can both sides be trained, or do we just function the way we are?
Yeah, I mean, we need both sides, because even both sides control.
And that happens organically?
Yes, yes. So, you know, you have between your two hemispheres, you have a bridge, which is called the corpus callosum. And that basically sends information that you're getting. So, for example, images that you see in your left hemisphere, you know, that also has to be transmitted to, you know, the other side of the brain so that you can see the whole world, you know, rather than just one side. And, you know, for you to be able to kind of do coordinated movements on both sides of your body, and to be able to balance so that you don't fall over, that needs information from, you know, both, you know, information that you're getting from, say, your joints about where your limbs are. That needs to go to both sides, you know, so that you can balance both sides of the body. So if you have strokes, say, at the corpus callosum, you can have problems in, you know, in terms of coordination or in terms of perceiving visual fields, because that information isn't crossing over to the other side. So, yeah, I mean, you, for the most part, for cognitive function, meaning for normal mental processes, you need
both sides
to talk to each other.
Sure. Mm. Dementia is not part of normal aging. That's one of the myths as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you hear that a lot, right? And mm-hmm. You just sort of think that, oh, you know, they're just growing old. But normal aging doesn't necessarily come with memory loss to the extent that you would see in dementia. In elderly individuals, yes, you can have situations where you may forget more frequently. And in some people, that may be a little bit more apparent. So you may be kind of diagnosed as having sort of what they call mild cognitive impairment. So, but that happens, you know, in some individuals. But there are sort of things that, you know, memory lapses that can happen in elderly that can be due to other things. So sometimes it happens when you're taking medication, or it happens when certain hormonal changes happen, or even any other kind of underlying medical condition can also kind of cause, you know, some sort of confusion or memory lapses. But so for example, if for normal aging, you can look up the internet, and there's some tables that you can sort of compare in terms of normal aging. Like, you know, you can maybe, you can't remember the name of an acquaintance. That's normal aging. Maybe you haven't met them a long time. And,
well,
you know,
that's happening already.
Yeah. That's true, right? You can remember the face, but always the name is a problem.
Yeah.
Right? But for example, people who have dementia, you don't recognize your family members or even their names. That's very different. You know, that is a big kind of sign. Other things, like you may forget things or events occasionally, but in dementia, you know, it happens more frequently. And you may find difficulty finding words in normal aging, but in dementia, you have, you may substitute certain words for others. You know, you may want actually to eat rice, but then you say you want to eat a bag, you know, something like that. So the right word doesn't come out, and you don't realize it. You know, sometimes in normal aging, you go, oh, sorry, you know, I didn't mean to say that. You know, actually, what's that word? You know, but in dementia, there's no kind of realization that there is a problem. So a lot of the time, you know, in normal aging, you know, you get worried because you realize that you have a, you know, that you've forgotten something. You know, you've forgotten your keys, you've forgotten your phone. But in dementia, other people sort of notice that you have memory loss.
There's no self-realization that it's happening.
So it's not part of normal aging. I mean, there are many people, elderly folk out there over the age of 70, 80, 90, who are very sharp. So, you know, just don't take it as sort of an inevitable part of aging, because, you know, there are now early interventions that can be done that can help people who may go on to develop dementia. So just, you know, be on the lookout, really.
And the next misconception: computer games make you smarter. We all seem to think our children are geniuses, especially when they can work the iPad or the iPhone at two.
I think all the parents are kind of hanging on to, okay, what is she going to say? It's school holidays. They're all at home. They're playing in their games. So, okay, scientifically speaking, if you go by sort of evidence, right? So if you look at certain games, so there have been a study that was published by a group in Canada in a journal, Nature, which is a highly regarded journal, just this year. So they looked at the impact of video games on plasticity of the hippocampus. So the hippocampus is basically part of the brain which is involved in memory, and plasticity means if whether or not you play computer games, it's going to change that part of your brain. So they use these sort of special games that tested people's spatial memory, meaning if you remember where things are located in an environment. And what they found was that if you play a game where the task was that you had to memorize the route, like how we would like memorize how to go to school, you know, then that did sort of seem to change that part of the brain. It seemed to increase what we call the gray matter, which is the part that contains the neurons. But if you played a game where you just sort of followed directions or it was a little bit more passive, then that didn't have that kind of effect. So I think, you know, there may be some computer games or video games that can be of help. And there was some evidence that said that if you play games that sort of require a lot of visual spatial coordination and hand-eye coordination as well, that may help, you know, but for overall cognition, again, you know, it doesn't sort of help necessarily. But of course, you know, if you're playing games, for example, that mathematics games or Scrabble or something like that, of course, that will be beneficial, more beneficial than sort of, you know, other games like, you know, just
Tetris
or, you know, shooting games, you know, shoot the dart.
Candy Crush,
yeah.
Pokemon Go.
Yeah, but you know, it is known that, you know, playing some... Actually, the thing is, last time we used to play games on the computer, you know, with the joystick or with the you know, keyboard or the mouse or whatever. But now with smartphones, you're playing games everywhere while you're waiting for the LRT, while you're waiting for your food to come, for example. And actually, they have found that because of you having to touch very small areas on your smartphone to sort of control where you want to go, that is changing the brain, because that's sort of, you're remodeling the part of the brain which is involved in controlling fine motor movement and sensing sort of these small areas. So that does
improve.
Indirectly have an impact on changing the brain, but whether or not it makes you overall smarter, you know.
Okay, so that's the verdict. It does not make you smarter.
Yeah, so be smart on the types of games that you let your kids play, and don't use it as a substitute for interacting with your children, because, you know, don't use it as a babysitter, because you think, well, that's going to make them just as smart as if I talk to them. No, talking to them eye to eye, you know, one-to-one contact is always far superior than just, you know, putting them in front of a baby genius program.
Speaking of baby genius, we all know when we were all pregnant at some stage, everybody said, play Mozart music to the babies in the womb, because then they become geniuses. And, you know, you see CDs, you see books out there about this whole method, Dr. Azlina. Yeah. Did we all waste our time, or is there some truth to that?
It probably just kind of made the babies calmer, enjoyed and appreciated music.
What about just classical music? Classical music is supposed to, you know, have a different effect on the brain.
In terms of, yeah, I mean, I think I've read a paper somewhere where they said that it's sort of, you know, you can have changes in the brain waves, right, when you play classical music. Yeah, I mean, I think there is some suggestion that, you know, playing classical music is helpful, maybe not in the sense that it helps your neurons fire better or whatever, but maybe in overall kind of, you know, calmness, and it helps you to sort of focus more, but, you know, that kind of thing. But I think what it's being used for now is being used for more commercial thing, you know, buy our CDs and play it to your child when it's in the womb, and that will make your child smarter. Now, that has no real scientific evidence linked to it. And in actual fact, this sort of thinking came about from a study in 1993 by this group, and they did it. What they did was that they asked people to listen to classical music, and they tested them on against a particular type of task, right? And they found that that improvement only really was observed for 15 minutes after listening to the music, and it wasn't a sort of longer term. So either we have to be constantly listening to classical music, or, you know, in actual fact, the author, one of the authors of the of that paper, who, when she was then later interviewed about this whole kind of, you know, commercial angle, you know, using Mozart, you know, for babies in the womb, she was really puzzled at how they made the jump from what she found in the paper to this sort of huge market now for all those sort of products. So, yeah, so I think the sort of general feeling is that don't use it as a surrogate, meaning that you don't use it and not do other things, you know. So still, you know, once the baby is born, you know, give them things to play with that stimulate their musical interest. Still play music, of course, when they're born. Let's send them to music classes, et cetera, et cetera. You know, play with them directly. You know, all that, again, has a far superior effect. Yeah.
Compared to just the classical music. The next one, old brains cannot learn. Mm. Can you teach old dogs new tricks, really?
Yes, for sure. For sure. I mean, I look at my father, for example, and he's been sort of learning WhatsApp and
that's what I've observed, Dr. Aslina. Some older people have taken on social media and, you know, that's, you know, all this technology, have embraced it really well.
Yes.
But some have completely not. And I think it's more psychologically that they have a fear. More than anything else. And that itself is a barrier. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's true. I have some sort of older relatives who still prefer the SMS way. Others sort of are very much more active on WhatsApp. I think sometimes it also depends on, you know, when they were working, what kind of jobs they did. So I think people who have embraced the technology, perhaps when they were working, they did a lot of computer work. So they're kind of familiar with
it's mindset as well, isn't it?
But in the case of my father, for example, I mean, he had a sort of secretary who did most of the computer stuff. So it was only really later on in his life where he sort of started picking it up. And, you know, he was doing sort of presentations on PowerPoint and, you know, learning all that. And he doesn't want me to do it. He wants to know how to do it. So, you know, and so I think, you know, when I look at that, I mean, you know, there's a huge capacity there for older brains to still learn new things, to still remember how to do things that, you know, if you had said to them 50 years ago, you know, they would have sort of laughed and said, you know, no way.
And it's important to keep learning.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's important to not be afraid, you know, of that kind of new technology. And in actual fact, you know, this thing about the old brain thing is because they always thought that we were born with the brain that we were ever going to have and that you can't change, you don't make any neurons. But actually, there is some studies that show that you do make new neurons in adult brains. So, you know, the capacity to learn is lifelong. You can teach that old dog
new tricks.
Yes.
But when you say neurons, tricks. That's different from brain cells. They're two different
neurons.
Things.
Yeah, yeah. So there is adult neurogenesis, meaning that you can make new neurons in the adult brain. And actually, that is even more apparent if you enrich your environment. So people who do a lot of exercise and who, you know, still have a lot of very rich social interaction, that actually, you know, has a positive effect on the production of these new brain cells. So
okay.
Actually, you know, they work hand in hand.
Sure.
Yeah.
Are the male and female brains different?
Yes and no. So there was the largest brain imaging study of its kind that was just published this year. It did find some sex-specific patterns, but overall, We are pretty much similar, as you would expect, really, because, you know, there are many functions that we do that aren't really related to gender. You know, how we move is the same between male and female, but there are certain parts of the brain that they found that were different. So, for example, in the women, okay, so overall, they found that men had a larger brain volume, okay, but in the women, they had these thicker parts of the brain in the cortex. Generally, the thicker cortices or thicker cortexes have been associated with sort of a range in scores in cognition and other sort of general intelligence tests. But the men had bigger brain volumes, so they had bigger areas for places like the hippocampus, which is involved in memory, amygdala, which is generally the kind of emotion part of the brain. Other parts of the brain, like the striatum, which is also involved in learning and the reward pathway, and parts of the brain called the thalamus, which is involved in sort of relaying sensory and other information to all parts of the brain. So
what does that mean? So, they have bigger brains than us.
Yeah, but you know, size doesn't necessarily kind of relate to superior ability. I mean, I think, you know, if we know that just by looking at male and female, we do process things differently. And I think it makes sense that, you know, different parts of the brain would also reflect that. But in general, like I said, we're not so different. This study, I have to say, that there was a caveat that some of the other researchers who weren't involved in the study, because the people who were enrolled were, in particular, women who were aged between 44 to 77 years old, and one of the things that they said was, you know, they didn't account for sort of hormonal changes that mm-hmm. happen during menopause, which can also have an effect on the brain. But I think this study kind of replicated some of what was already shown before, but it was just sort of, in terms of number, it was the largest sort of sample size that had been done before.
So verdict.
In terms of verdict, I mean, it's still controversial whether or not these sort of different patterns, you know, different brain patterns relate to anything in general about intelligence or behavior.
Okay. The next one, can we catch up on our sleep over the weekends?
So, so sleep, I'll tell you something a little bit worrying about sleep first, and then we'll kind of come back to answering whether or not we can catch up. So there was, another study around the middle of this year where they said that just one night of interrupted sleep can cause a 10% increase in proteins that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. So these proteins are ones like beta amyloid and also tau. And in particular, if you lost what was known as a slow wave sleep, so these are like these very deep sleep, which are non-REM sleep, they were sort of saying that, you know, even just one night, and I remember reading that and I remember going, oh my goodness, because, you know, so many of us spend multiple nights of interrupted sleep, and that's worrying. But basically what they're saying is we need a kind of block sleeping time of up to between 6 to 8 hours of sleep, this uninterrupted good sleep. And why is that? It is because while we sleep, our brain is sort of doing a kind of clearance. So we're kind of getting rid of certain kind of byproducts that happen just normally in our cells through the day. So what they found is that the sort of fluid that bathes our brain and also the spinal cord, known as the cerebrospinal fluid or CSF, that filters the brain sort of while you sleep, and that sort of gets rid of these sort of, you know, byproducts and potentially toxic byproducts. And that takes 6 to 8 hours to kind of complete. So if you kind of interrupt that, then obviously you don't clear the brain as well as you should. So the problem is with, you know, assuming that you, well, you know, you've got a huge deadline. Okay, well, I'll sort of work through the night and then I'll just sort of catch up, you know, over the weekend. Well, that one night of interrupted sleep will also have an effect in terms of the possible beta amyloid and tau deposition or accumulation. And not only that, you're also not clearing what you kind of accumulated that day. So, you know, the next day, then it's still there. And so then when you assume that Saturday, you'll sleep and it'll clear everything, but there's a huge kind of backlog. So then that's sort of carried forward and so on and so forth. So I think in that sense, biologically, you can't, it's difficult to kind of catch up on that sense. And that you can also see people who have chronic sleeplessness. You know, they have multiple other issues, like in terms of, they always say that they think fuzzy, right? Mm-hmm. You can't think so clearly. And also general health. So if you imagine, you know, just like you're at home, you don't clear the rubbish away from your home and it accumulates. But then when the rubbish lorry comes and it only takes a fraction of that, but you're still left with a lot of toxic rubbish, and the toxic rubbish continues to decay, continues to accumulate, and that will have a knock-on effect on your health. So I know it's very difficult nowadays to get the right amount of sleep that we should be, but, you know, just do try to, because now, like I said, you know, more and more research is done on sleep. Last time people thought, you know, sleep doesn't matter, nothing happens during sleep. But now people are recognizing more and more that sleep is a really integral part of our health.
So to be cognizant about that. We'll come back and bust the last two myths up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Sivasodi. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, our neurogeneticist, in the studio with us in our 10th episode of Brain Waves. We are looking at misconceptions about the brain. The last two we're going to go through now is DHA. Everybody talks about how you need to make sure you have DHA in your diet, or whether you need to supplement because it's crucial to brain health. Your thoughts on that?
Going by the evidence of studies that have been published, so DHA, the story behind the DHA, of course, you know, in terms of some research that was done in Japan, in particular on the aging population. So they found that because the Japanese diet is very rich in fish. And so, and when they looked many years ago at the kind of prevalence of dementia in Japan, there was a lower prevalence than what you would expect in that kind of country and also globally. But actually now I have to say that Japan is also catching up in terms of the dementia prevalence. But, you know, so the idea kind of that fish is good came from sort of there. And then of course, fish has sort of many kind of components in it, with DHA being one, or this omega-3 fatty acids. So, you know, you can see where the jump went from DHA is good. So then the jump was then, well, we'll put DHA in everything, formula milk, everything. Even now, I think they put it in eggs. You know, I've seen sort of some eggs.
Yes.
DHA-enriched, antibiotic-free, DHA-enriched. But there was, again, if you look at evidence-based, right, there was a kind of review of studies. It kind of showed that there was no clear evidence that supplementation, formula supplementation with DHA, improved infant brain health. But they also found that there was no harm. So it didn't mean, so, you know, if you're taking it, you can still take it. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to stop taking it because it's going to be helpful.
Not going to make a difference.
Yeah, it doesn't make, just don't think that it's going to be kind of a magic bullet, you know, in terms of making somebody smart. I mean, brain health depends on having a balanced diet. You know, it's not just one component, or not just one supplement, say. You know, you need to make sure that you're having a varied diet to be able to, you know, help all brain functions. Yeah.
Okay. And the last one, a knock on the head does not make you less clever. To put it very,
yeah,
you know, politely. Well, actually, some of us think a knock on the head can actually affect us.
Yeah, well, actually, that one, it is an old myth, isn't it?
I mean,
I remember I heard it in school. They always said that, you know, if you want to discipline a child, you know, you can kind of pinch their bottom, but don't ever hit their head, you know. people are very particular if, you know, a child falls over, and if they say they get a bruise on their elbow, they're like, yeah, they'll be all right. But then if they fall on their head, they're always like, oh, you know, and is there any truth in that? So actually, this part I wanted to sort of mention more on sort of studies that have been done on football injuries, especially currently quite a big thing in the States, whereby there have been a number of cases of these professional footballers, then later they go on to develop dementia, quite a large proportion of them.
Well, boxing and, as well.
Yeah, and boxing, of course, yeah. So any kind of, you know, long-term traumatic injury to the brain. And in particular, the kind of condition that they're looking at in these football players is not smartness, so to speak, but this condition called a chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE for short. And what that causes is the sort of depression, causes depression and impaired emotions. And so there was a case, I think a sensational case, of one of the professional football player, of course, we know it better as rugby, but American football. And then he committed suicide after he was charged with killing someone. His parents then let the doctors look at his brain, post-mortem examination, and they found that he had this condition, this CTE condition, and research has shown that, you know, traumatic, sort of repeated traumatic brain injury can affect these things. And they had sort of said many years prior to him sort of doing this sort of killing the person, he had already started showing these sort of different behavioral changes. So they propose that, you know, actually there needs to be more research that needs to be done into football brain injuries. Football, this in this case,
American football,
but also soccer. Football as we know it here. And actually in the UK, they are now going to fund a study into football, soccer, brain injury. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. And so I kind of included this just to, because, you know, I have two boys and they like to play football. And I also worry, you know, because you imagine that, you know, this sometimes they head, you know, when they do headers. And the ball comes to them at such amazing kind of speed, and it's a hard ball. And there was a study that sort of said that the impact at different ages is also different. Children at between 7 to 12, the impact of sort of heading these balls will be different from, you know, people who do it in teenagehood and in adulthood, you know. So, and you imagine that boys, you know, they play football from very young and they play it and for lifelong. So it's also, as a mother, I guess I was sort of interested in sort of including that, because, you know, people are looking at that more seriously.
Yeah. The girls are playing football as well.
Yeah, of course. Not to be sexist. Sorry, girls. Yes. Yeah.
So verdict for that one? Depends how hard, depends how frequent.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to keep an eye out for the research that's going to come out after they do the study and really see what they say. But I think, you know, the football academies do need to be a little bit mindful in terms of, you know, the training that you do. And, you know, you can play football with other parts of your body.
Yeah,
and,
so perhaps not allow headers anymore.
Yeah, I mean, especially with, you know, don't an adult kick at a child, you know, because obviously that will be much more impact on the head. You know, if a 7-year-old kid kicks and a 7-year-old kid does the header, then that is less impact rather than a 40-year-old coach kicking and expecting a 7-year-old boy to do a header. You know, so just be mindful, I think, because as I said, you know, the changes that you see may not be apparent immediately. You can have, you know, deterioration that happens in the brain 20, 30 years before you get to see the symptoms. So just because you don't see changes in your child now doesn't mean that it's not going to have an impact later on in life. So just be careful.
Okay. Yeah. It's the end of the year. It's your last show for the year. What's your message?
Enjoy your holidays.
Yeah, we'll see you next year for sure.
Yes. We'll look forward to more discussions next year.
Yes. And your message on brain myths?
Take it with a pinch of salt. And always, I mean, for me, you know, try to get both sides of the story, and companies don't capitalize on it.
Have a blessed new year, Dr. Azlina. That was Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, our neurogeneticist, on our 10th episode of Brain Myths. See you next year on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.